This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The paradox of social media is that it has at once created broader connections and deeper isolation. Many of us hang out exclusively in our digital silos, affirming our beliefs and engaging in safe arguments that don't really threaten to change our worldview. But for those of us interested in seeing what's on the minds of other communities, these spaces on Facebook and Twitter are windows into new realms of thought. Today, we'll launch a new series on the state of things. We're calling it Culture 360. And joining us are two of our regular contributors, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's an award-winning and Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker, currently working on Bartman, Beyonce, and Me, her first feature-length documentary film as a director. She's also assistant professor of film at St. Augustine's University. Welcome back, Natalie. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Frank. Thanks.
Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke, also the author of several books and the blog New Black Man, and host the weekly video webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
So let's talk about, we're talking about Black Twitter and social media, but in particular in spheres in African-American communities. So tell us about Black Twitter. Because, you know, this is public radio. And we've never heard of it.
So, you know, for me, I have to, you know, to get people to wrap their head around it, to think about it in an analog world.
Right.
And for me, growing up in the Bronx, that analog world was sitting on the stoop on summer nights, right? And there, everybody in the community sitting there, and they're having all kinds of conversations about why Muhammad Ali is the greatest and whether or not Bill Withers was abusing his wife, you know, Denise Nicholas at the time. I mean, all those kind of rich conversations. This is New York City, mid-1970s, on the verge of bankruptcy. You know, all those kinds of conversations, right? Nixon's a crook. And so you have all these rich conversations. And so these conversations that occur on the stoop, in the barbershop, in the beauty parlor, right? In these informal public spaces, you know, Black Twitter is really the translation of those spaces in a digital realm.
Does it work that way, Natalie? Do you think is it the stoop of the digital world?
I definitely see the parallel. I have to just make a confession straight up, which is that my Twitter game has only recently gotten together.
And we're working on that.
We are working on it. But I think, you know, Black Twitter, even though I have pretty much participated in it as a observer, what I love about it is that it absolutely is a space that Black people have sort of carved out of this larger entity and made it their own. So the hashtags that pop up in Black Twitter, you know, you're not going to have these conversations, in the boardroom or in the classroom even necessarily. So I think Black Twitter has it is fascinating, and it's definitely important in that it allows all these voices to weigh in on conversations that need to be had. I mean, and that just don't happen enough.
Well, Mark, so, and the effect is, of course, those conversations that you were having in the Bronx on the stoop in the 1980s might be happening all over the country, but you wouldn't have known that. Now you can, and more people can weigh in.
I mean, the thing about Black Twitter is the transition that it's gone through. You know, Twitter's not even 10 years old. Right. And it started really as a back channel, right, where there's a mainstream culture that's existed in terms of mainstream Twitter. And it's a way for Black folks to be able to communicate with each other as a back channel, right, on the side, right, you know, without having to participate in the mainstream conversation. What we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years is that back channel now is really the thing that is pushing forward, conversation, right? So we've seen Black Twitter have direct impacts in terms of things around policy, criminal investigations, you know, obviously in terms of how we hold law enforcement accountable and things of that nature.
How does it change the conversation to know that you're not just, I mean, if you're standing on the stoop, you know who's listening pretty much. But when you're on Twitter, other people are parachuting in, and you're right, it's having this deeper impact. So it may be a conversation among ourselves, but we know other people are listening. How is that having, what impact does that have in the conversation?
I'm going to bring up Sandra Bland, because I think that from what I have heard and observed about conversations regarding what actually happened to her, the speculation, the theories, has really been hashed out on Black Twitter. And what I've heard, I don't know this for a fact, but I've heard that there are white people who do not, who basically believe that Sandra Bland is responsible for her own death, who have popped in as profiles of Black people right. in order to participate, but have really inflamed the conversation with all kinds of hateful comments. And so it's interesting, this idea of knowing who is in the conversation, because I think that is the dilemma with Black Twitter, is that you don't know right. if people that are participating in those conversations are actually Black, are actually the ones that you would invite onto your stoop.
And yet you can't make the assumption that if there's inflammatory or derogatory language, that it's always coming from people who aren't. I mean, and the question, not only who's participating, but who's listening and then drawing that out into mainstream media. The LA Times, hired a young writer and culture critic, Dexter Thomas, right? And he's starting to report on Black Twitter for the LA Times. And he was talking to Brooke Gladstone on the media about mainstream media using Twitter to get a Black perspective. Here's what he said.
The thing is, and we have to face, is Black people are scary. I'm speaking from a mainstream American experience. They're very interested in observing them. And they're very interested in, things like hip hop and things like jazz and whatnot. But when it actually comes to speaking to somebody, it's a little bit scary. So where this leaves reporters is finding a safe Black person to talk to. And sort of every network's got one or two of those. But now we don't need that anymore, because actually what we can do is we can just glance at Twitter and say, oh, well, this is what Black people think. We see a lot of roundups and listicles saying, here's what Black Twitter said last night. That fulfills the diversity requirement of any media outlet. Oh, look, at least we're talking about Black people here. But you're not. You're talking about a very fractured subset of Black internet users.
So his point is so critical here, right? Black Twitter is not a monolith, right? It's a way to connect to Black ideas. It's a crowdsourcing of Black ideas, right? It's a crowdsourcing of Black thought. But what's also important here is that how cyclical this is, right? 50th anniversary coming up of the Watts riots. And so many Black reporters got hired at mainstream newspapers and television stations because white reporters were afraid to go into the hood to report these stories. Watts in 65, Newark in 67, of course, everything that explodes, post-King assassination in 68. And so the fact now Black Twitter even is an iteration of that, except now folks don't have to go anywhere near the hood, right? Do a form of kind of surveillance, right? When On the Media did this great piece, I raised the question, is this good reporting? Or is it surveillance, right? or is it some sort of combination of both?
This is one of the scary things. It's not just fear for your body going into a neighborhood where something might happen to you. It's fear of messing up. It's fear of saying that inappropriate
thing.
Getting
the story wrong.
Yeah, getting the story wrong or saying the wrong thing and having to be corrected. And so, if you feel like you're on the right side of the issue, you certainly don't want to prove it by standing there and talking with somebody who you don't know and being told that was an offensive thing to say.
Right.
Part of the deal, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you kind of have to put yourself out there in order to be able to engage fully in the conversation.
Right.
And the reality is, I'm Black, but I don't always get it right. I'm still I'm processing. There's so much that has to be thought about. Right. So many implications that, are not necessarily obvious. It is a process that I think all of us are working through. Some of us are quicker than others. But I really appreciate it when on Twitter and on Facebook there are white people who are trying to grapple with these issues around race and are willing to put themselves on the line in order to better understand what's going on, because they really want to understand. And, I commend them for that.
Yeah, the willingness to get it wrong is the way
right.
forward.
Right.
Exactly.
Because that's how these corrections happen. Well, so we'll stick with Dexter for a moment, because he also talks about Dexter Thomas, the diversity on Twitter and sort of how we have come to see it as a monolith and maybe we're making a mistake.
As far as we know in the media, Black Twitter is two things. It's people getting mad about police brutality and Beyonce jokes. So how do we reconcile that? We can't. There are people in Black Twitter who identify themselves as being part of Black Twitter. And when bad things happen to Black men, they're the first ones to talk about it, and they're very angry. But when bad things happen to Black women, they're nowhere to be found. But then on the other hand, you do have people who are part of Black Twitter who say, hey, that's not okay. all Black Lives Matter. It's really fragmented, is what I'm saying. Black Twitter is just like white Twitter.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that if you think about all the different things that are going on right now, I mean, you know, from jokes about Beyonce to police brutality and the gamut in between, there is a lot to be said for the fact that Black Twitter does reflect the fact that we are not a monolithic people, that we have varying experiences within the American experience that we share in common. But we have all these different frames of reference that are kind of coming together within this Twitterverse. And I think it's important that is remembered, not only by those who participate in it, but certainly when Mark talks about surveillance and whether or not reporters are actually engaging with the people that they're reporting on. They have to remember they can't talk to one person and then say that represents what Black people
think. Here's what Black Twitter said today.
Yes.
Like, what on earth could that mean?
Right.
Is there a danger, though, Mark, that this is all just a form of entertainment and distraction, that it really doesn't move the conversation forward, that we're all entertained and distracted from the real business of making this a just society?
I think the entertainment part of it is important, right? And the great example I'll use of this is classic Public Enemy and the work that Public Enemy did in terms of, quote-unquote, conscious raising hip-hop 25 years ago, 25th anniversary of Fear of a Black Planet. And as much as Chuck D talked fight the power, what kept people in the room was that Public Enemy was rap music that, A, you could dance to,
right,
and you would be entertained by Flavor Flav.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Flavor
That's right.
Flav was, you know, was the thing that helped it go down a little smoother.
That's right.
And when it's all said and done, you know, the political song from Public Enemy that resonated the most from folks is the song that Chuck doesn't appear on. Right. It's 9-1-1 is a joke. Right. Everybody understood, no matter what their political point of view was, that if you're Black in the hood and you call EMS, they are not going to come when you need them to.
Well, that brings us actually to N.W.A., because now Straight Outta Compton, the new biopic that purports to tell the story of N.W.A., again, a kind of consciousness-raising group. Film takes a look at L.A. in those turbulent times, the creation of the group. And the film producers, of course, members of the group or their family. Mark, take us back a bit. Tell us about the influence of N.W.A.
Negroes with an attitude. and let's start with the fact that it's not Negroes.
Right.
Not. And, you know, they were the cutting edge of what we think of as kind of L.A. gangster rap, you know, from the late 1980s and early 1990s. And what gangster rap was, it was a soundtrack of buy and bust police practices on the ground in Los Angeles, right? You know, the first real significant gangster rap song is a song called Batarang by Toddy T, which was about this little machine that the LAPD had that if they suspected that there were drugs in your house, this little Batarang would bang down your doors, right? And so N.W.A. really, you know, was trying to capture what that meant on the ground. Sexist, misogynist, all the whole package in that regard. And so the idea that 25 years later, you know, that we would be almost celebrating the moment that was N.W.A. because, you know, the Uber producer of N.W.A. is a billionaire.
Right.
Right. And the primary lyricist, you know, who was a visionary even at 19, you know, is a Hollywood mogul. You know, it's a pretty fascinating story in terms of thinking about Black come up.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit of a clip that we've got Ice Cube and Dr. Dre in this clip from in the trailer, part of the trailer. Let's listen.
Welcome to Compton.
What up, man?
Okay,
Dr.
Dre. Okay. Where it all started.
We put it all in the music, all our frustration and anger. Our music was like our weapon.
And that's the most powerful weapon we got.
What's up, man?
What a lot of people don't realize about N.W.A. is nonviolent protest. We let people know that it's okay to say what you want to say. It's crazy to see how all these different people around the world feel the same way that we feel. We kicked the door down for a lot of artists.
Game time. What's up?
The foundation that was set by y'all, man, I'm so appreciative. You know, I just try to keep the flame lit.
What's up?
When I think of N.W.A., it wasn't really music to me. It was more like a real lifestyle. Brothers from my neighborhood that made it out.
The same thing that we was going through in the 80s with the police people going through right now.
It's a good time for us to tell our story. Some kids from Compton, how we touched the world.
Well, on that point, I mean, the story hasn't changed much. We thought that it had, maybe sometime at the end of the 90s, and here we are again, or should I say still.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, how much Dre saying it's a good time to tell our story resonates because, you know, I think with Ferguson and Baltimore and the things that I think a lot of Americans are finding out about what it's like to be black in, you know, in some of these small cities, really throughout the country,
right.
You know, is eye opening. And I think that's what NWA did at the time that they came out. They were talking about a reality that, you know, a lot of us, black and white, had no clue about and really had a hard time relating to. And now I think, you know, it's perfect. This is exactly the time, I think, for an NWA biopic to come out.
How much of it, Mark, is sort of just a reflection of that life? And then as Dr. Dre said, the, you know, the idea that you would reflect an experience and other people's just hearing your own experience gives you permission to talk about it in a public way. How much of it is that and how much of it is a kind of call to action?
I think it's all of the above, right? I think this is the generation, when you think about Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, I mean, they don't know a way other than to do protests without it being connected to commerce. You know, After Police worked because After Police was an album that you could go buy and listen to, right? Because they couldn't perform it, right, in some venues. So I think they understand that dynamic, that if you want to reach people on a broad level around protest issues, the market is one of the places where you're going to have to go to do that kind of work. And, you know, there's been a lot of kind of critique about what hip-hop is or what hip-hop isn't. And you'll hear, you know, kind of folks our generation go, you know, when's the next Public Enemy or when's the next Brand Nubian or some group like that? And I always respond, you know, I actually want to know when's the next NWA, because once you get past the kind of political esoteria that you might have heard in a Public Enemy, you know, NWA's F the Police. Everybody understood that. Right. You know, so when Dre says that, you know, 25 years later, a whole new generation of folks that resonates for them in a different kind of way, I think he's speaking some real truth around
that. Absolutely.
But what's the impact? I mean, again, it allows people to say we have a shared experience, and that can be a force for political mobilization. You say, well, wait a minute, I'm not alone here. And this is the truth of our experience, well articulated. So it's a commercial success. Fine. That shouldn't dismiss the power. But then the effect, is there something about sort of the late 90s and the early 2000s that makes those effects more ephemeral or evanescent? They don't last as long.
You know, I think one of the things that occurred with both Public Enemy and NWA is that, you know, they were making their commentaries outside of an actual existing social movement. And I think it's a different moment now, because now you can kind of connect the dots. It's, you know, there's a very visible social movement in response to attacks on black bodies and law enforcement and a range of other things. And suddenly the music is connecting. I mean, I think it's so important in this moment when we think about the Black Lives Matter movement is that, you know, when you talk about this moment and them gathering in Cleveland 2 weeks ago, you need to talk about Gary. Right. In 1972, you need to talk about NWA. You need to talk about the Black Radical Congress in the late 1990s that created the digital infrastructure that Black Twitter is, you know, now in 2015. And I think it's a moment where we can start to connect the dots.
Yes.
Right. This moment of handheld cameras. Right. You know, whether we're talking about Sandra Bland or body cams with cops or dashboard cams without Rodney King getting his butt beat. And the holiday video
right.
being shot
right.
from up in the hotel, capturing it, where we're not having any of these conversations.
Right, right. I just want to add that, you know, I think, well, Mark said it, that the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, really does allow for an opportunity to connect the dots and for a lot, you know, for all of us to learn and understand some of that history that has been obscured, but that without, we would not really have a Black Lives Matter movement or moment. And I think that, you know, it's really interesting and will continue to be so, for me at least, to watch how the music that we have now is feeding that movement and reflecting. You know, and they feed off of each other, actually.
On the State of Things, Culture 360, our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, debuting a new radio series on The State of Things, calling it Culture 360, examining the intersections of identity, culture, politics, and the media, with two regular contributors to The State of Things, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And we're going to talk about the new book by author Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. The book is an open letter to his son about what it means to be a black man in contemporary society. And it created a buzz. It was released early, in fact. The buzz was so powerful around this book. Tell us about the impact of it, Mark.
I think whenever we have the larger society celebrating a black essayist, you know, a genre of writing that seemingly has disappeared, you know, over the years, I think that's an important thing. When we think about the legacy of Ralph Ellison as an essayist, when you think about the legacy of June Jordan as an essayist, right? And of course, Baldwin, you know, in the case, you know, as Ta-Nehisi references him, obviously, throughout the book. I think it's important to have this now generation focused in on people doing very nice, stylistic, nuanced arguments around nonfiction, some of it autobiographical, obviously. But so I think the fact that we're celebrating this at all is very important.
What about the impact, the importance of it as a letter from one black man to his black son? In other words, a conversation within a black community that we're overhearing if you're white.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that in an interview that I heard Ta-Nehisi have, an interview that Ta-Nehisi did recently, he says that the book is really a reflection of conversations he's been having with his son, that it's not something new that he's trying to impart to him. But I do think that it is interesting that the book is being received by a white audience, and certainly there are black readers. But from what I can gather, you know, there's a lot of interest by white readers in Ta-Nehisi's vision, or not his vision, but his accounting of the black experience from his perspective. And I think it's because he is kind of invoking these essayists of the past in his language and in the way that he approaches race. But, I think the most interesting thing that I have read about his book and where he seems to be coming from is that he, for black people, is not churchy enough, that he's not focusing on this idea of hope in terms of the black experience, but he's focusing on the struggle, and that he doesn't then offer any sort of solution at the end, like, you know, we just need to pray and come together and it'll all be all right. Mm-hmm. That's not his position. And I think that speaks also to what's kind of going on in this moment, this Black Lives Matter moment, where there are people who have grown up in the church, have a relationship with the gospel, I'll say, but at the same time are kind of stepping back from it and saying, but how is it actually really working right now in this moment, practically, as we live our lives? How does it show up in our experience? And I think Ta-Nehisi is really challenging that.
Well, he is. And in an interview on the CBC, he was talking about racism as a physical experience, what a man might say to his son and what, as a white person, you would have to overhear. Let's listen to this clip.
One of the big points in the book is this idea that racism is a physical experience for black people. It's a visceral experience. It is not theoretical. It is not philosophical. It has to do at every step with you trying to find some way to safeguard your body. Racism as a physical thing was true during the era of enslavement. It is true today. We have seen that, obviously, in this quote-unquote wave, which really isn't a wave, of killings by police officers of African-Americans, or, you know, African-Americans being roughly handled by police officers. But behind every single one of those instances is a seemingly abstract policy. For instance, the killing of Walter Scott in South Carolina as he was shot in the back by a police officer. What's behind that is policy decisions that we've made about how we deal with child support in this country. The killing of Freddie Gray, where, you know, the incident that, you know, starts it off is an officer sees him, they make eye contact, and, you know, he thinks Freddie Gray is running from him. He's arrested, and he ends up dead. Well, had that same, you know, behavior been witnessed on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, in New York City, where I live, it's highly unlikely the officer would then chase the person down and arrest them. What's behind that is drug policy. So all these sort of abstract ideas that we hold out here, ultimately, at the end of the day, are physical threats. Mm-hmm. And Black people feel that, you know, and it conditions a lot of how we respond to things. And fear is a dominating emotion.
You know, there's a way in which Ta-Nehisi's new book, you know, is obviously a follow-up to his first book, The Beautiful Struggle. The Beautiful Struggle was a letter to his younger self. You know, this is a book that's, you know, obviously a letter to his son. And I think if there's a place where he can be held accountable and critiqued, it is around this idea that somehow this is a male-dominated space. I think there are many parents increasingly, particularly in relationship to public school education, educational institutions in general, that, you know, where we always talk about having to have the conversation with our sons, so many of us are going to have that conversation with our daughters, right? When we saw what happened in Texas at the swimming pool, when we see the Sandra Bland video, right, and ultimately what gets her killed, why she's even incarcerated, because she's a Black woman who speaks back.
Right.
And so now we have to have this conversation with our 12, 13, 8-year-old daughters around this kind of dynamic, because now even, you know, where Ta-Nehisi talks about the body, and we get that, right? Black men walking to a space and are immediately their threat simply because of physicality. You know, for Black women, in some cases it might be physicality, but for Black women, it's literally their mouth that becomes the threat.
That's right.
Their mouth and their use of language is what gets them killed.
That's right. And, you know, the as a mom of a 12-year-old son, you know, I always have Tamir Rice in my head because, you know, if not for the grace of God, there goes EJ. And, you know, it is this idea of Black people, of racism being a physical experience is so heavy because, you know, to have to tell your son that you have to carry yourself in a certain way that they
right.
can't even really understand, mm-hmm. you know, as a 12-year-old, because they're just doing what 12-year-olds do, right? You know, it's very it's difficult, I mean, to say the least, but it hurts to have to impart that sort of you know, warning and instruction to a 12-year-old son. And, you know, and then the thing that's behind that, when Ta-Nehisi talks about policy, you know, there have been studies that show that white people see Black boys as young as 10 years old as adults.
Right.
They see them
right.
as men. And so if you have a 10, 12-year-old, any son that's over the age of 10 walking around, and you know that
right.
they are being seen as an adult, which means that they are they are a threat
right.
in a different way than a child would be. You know, that's just, I mean, what do you do with that?
Well, and it's the water we're swimming in, right? So what's normal and what's not? And so all of these stereotypes that we normalize, women are not supposed to talk back. Therefore, you really stepped out of line. And so
right.
you've violated, right? You've transgressed the physical threat, the physicality of the experience of being Black in this country, the burden you bear physically is something that we don't translate as well. What's easy for us to understand, all of us to understand, is that a police officer faces many threats. So when we hear that I was charged by a man, even though I saw no gun, and I'm trained to look for a gun, I saw no gun, but a man ran at me. Well, you know, he's an officer. His life's in danger. He's got a gun. He's got a taser. He's got a club at his side.
Right.
The guy running at you doesn't have. And so we normalize the experience of a threatened officer, and we should. We should think about and care about our peace officers, but not to be able to see what a physical threat it is to your life to be a Black man in America is the hard thing to translate. It's hard to get that over the wall, right?
Yeah. I mean, it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, this is not brand new, right? You know, what is the humanity of Blackness, right? We live
right.
in a society historically has not recognized Black humanity. And folks had to go through all kinds of extenuating circumstances to get people to recognize even some semblance of that humanity.
Yeah. And can I just add that, you know, in terms of Black women, we're not necessarily seen as women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you
mm-hmm.
think about how Serena Williams is characterized,
mm-hmm.
has been characterized for years. And, you know, people think she looks like a man and all of these just taunts about her body. You know, it average black women experience that as well. So if your humanity is questioned, on top of the fact that you are seen as more of a threat because you're not even seen as feminine, I mean, it's very complicated, you know, what all seems to go through the mind of someone who encounters a black man or even a black woman.
And then one of the byproducts of that is that, you know, black folks then never get to enjoy and be comfortable in their own bodies, right? And then when you bring into it, you know, the black church in some sort of context, that makes us shameful of our bodies and what we do with our bodies. It's like, if you're a black person, what do you do with this body, right? There's no, your body is not a safe haven for
that. Right.
No safe haven, in a conversation I don't have to have with my son, because it's not that he'll never do that kind of thing. If he does, he's not going to get shot.
Right.
He can mouth off. He can puff up his chest. And if he's stopped on the side of the road, it just might mean an extra citation.
When we saw those white bikers down in Texas mouthing off, I mean, literally, like, all kinds of violence, and they get a timeout. You know, sit down right there, sit right down on the grass and you know, take a couple of deep breaths and we'll go get you some candy and some water. And, you know, the fact that the escapee from the prison up in New York State, you know, when they do catch him, he's actually given oxygen
for him to breathe. Right.
And Eric Garner didn't get any kind of that kind of sensibility.
Right.
Let's move on to music. A couple of artists making big waves in popular music, rappers Kendrick Lamar and Vince Staples, both rappers from the West Coast. Taking very different approaches to their craft. Kendrick Lamar's newest album, To Pimp a Butterfly, Vince Staples' record, Summertime 06. It's got a little more of a street sound to it. Obviously, there's more jazz and a kind of an eclectic sound in Kendrick Lamar's. What do you make of these two artists, Mark?
I think it's wonderful. It's been a long time since folks had been excited about new music, you know, new pop music, right? And it really begins with, you know, D'Angelo's December Surprise with Black Messiah, and then Kendrick follows that up with, you know, To Pimp a Butterfly. And suddenly folks are talking about the music, right? Not necessarily talking about the images, not necessarily talking about beef, you know, a la Drake and Meek Mill, but actually talking about the music. And to Kendrick's credit, he created a musical statement. Yes, he's dropping bars and he's saying some important things, but musically, this was a critically important album.
Absolutely. I think sonically, Kendrick Lamar's album, and again, confession time, I have not been engaged in popular culture, pop music or hip hop in particular in a minute. So for me to be just over the moon about Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, I just feel like he is saying all kinds of important things, but musically it is a cohesive statement, and it to me harkens back to concept albums, you know, that I can't really think of someone off the top of my head right now, but I think that he
Prince
is
Sign of the Times.
Absolutely, thank you. You know, there are others that if I had a moment I could pull up, but definitely, I think he is, for his age in particular, he is pulling in all kinds of elements that create this atmosphere in through which he talks about some very important things on, I think, a very high level.
Let's listen to a little bit of the song, All Right. When you know we've been hurt, been down before, nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po, when they kill us dead in the street for sure. Nigga, I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
Okay, so if y'all were in here with me and Mark, oh my God,
right.
that is my jam. I just have to say, and I think it's because it is maybe, you know, kind of the opposite of Ta-Nehisi. It is hopeful. Mm, you know, we are gonna be all right. Yeah. But it has such a I don't know. It's so grounded in this idea that, you know, things are the way they are. You know, he's not sugarcoating anything. He's kind of saying, in spite of all that, we're going to be all right. you know, we're going to do our thing. We are going to live our lives and it's going to be fine. And I really love what I have been observing in footage that I've seen from the Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives convening that happened in Cleveland a couple of weeks ago. Every piece of footage that I've seen where the conveners come together and they're protesting or they're rallying, they say we gonna be all right. Mm. They use that. Mm. And I think it's really interesting that they've pulled this this song, this phrase and refrain from Kendrick Lamar into this political movement.
You know, Natalie and I were talking off air because, you know, generally when you think about Black social protest music, I mean, they always pull the music out of the archive, right? You know, We Shall Overcome came out of the archive and then got, you know, refashioned into something else. Fight the Power, to some extent, comes out of the archive, right? The Isley Brother archive, and gets reconstituted. You know, this is a case where an artist is right in the pocket, right? It's James Brown doing Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. It's Aretha singing Respect. It's Marvin singing What's Going On, right? And Kendrick might not have had any designs on this, right? He was just making a song that was heartfelt about Black folks and his community, but it's resonating, right? And again, the fact that it's hopeful, right, that in all of this mess, right, it finds some sort of glimpse to say that we've gotten through this before. We've always gotten through this. Y'all are going to get this, too. We're going to be all right.
That's right.
And we're going to do it again. Thank you so much. We're out of time right now, but thank you so much. Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke. Natalie Bullock Brown is an award-winning and Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker, and we'll have her back probably next month, but also when that film comes out, Bartman, Beyonce, and me. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mwagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern, and Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.